Hi, I'm Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Every year at this time, we get excited to immerse ourselves in the buzz and bustle at the Vermont State House as lawmakers either get back to work in the second year of the session or begin a new session full of pomp and circumstance and new members getting to know where they'll sit, what their committee assignments are going to be, and what the best options are in the cafeteria. Hint, they're all great. But this year, we're not there, and neither are most lawmakers. Though various ideas had been floated for how to start the new biennium, eventually it was decided that the session will be mostly remote, at least for now. So opening ceremonies are primarily virtual. What I've been told is that the smaller Senate body will have a significant number of members in the State House today, but the House is completely virtual with the exception of the presiding officer, House clerk, Secretary of State, and a couple of representatives in the chamber. But if it looks and feels very different this year than most, it's also driven by the global emergency Vermont is a part of and the state's response to COVID-19 as we continue to see a rise in cases, a slower than desired rollout of the vaccine, and concerns about the economic repercussions of the pandemic. So there is an urgency in the State House today, virtually, that I think pervades all of Vermont and all Vermont lawmakers as they get started with the important business of legislation. Today, we're going to talk to some of the people who work at the State House and make it run, as well as three new lawmakers. And we'll start with the legislature's chief economist, Tom Cavett. Tom, nice to talk with you again. Thank you for joining us remotely today.
Thank you, Jane. Glad to be here.
Can you just briefly describe your role and what you actually provide to the legislature and to state leaders more broadly?
I am the administration economist. I look at economic externals, things that affect the economy, and try to assess exactly how those are going to those events are going to impact state revenues. And this current year and the next year into the future. So we're looking at impacts from things like that and trying to quantify them with respect to revenues the state will have.
And how do you work with Jeffrey Carr, the governor's chief economic advisor? Because the two of you work together in many ways and present things to the state in many ways together, but you obviously also have different perspectives.
Yeah, well, we prepare independent forecasts, but we also do a consensus recommendation. So it's there used to be, way back, two separate forecasts that would be out there, and it created a lot of confusion and wasn't really serving the process. So Jeff and I, many years ago, started doing a consensus version of that, and that is typically what ends up being accepted. But that's presented at the emergency board, which this year I think is on the 19th. And that becomes the basis of all the budgetary discussions in terms of how much money's available.
Do you and Jeff Carr think of yourselves as having a better working relationship than the legislature and the governor typically do? Or are you as contentious as those two relationships can be?
Well, there are a lot of disagreements, but I actually think in Vermont there's greater civility and better back and forth. We will argue issues, but these are largely technical sorts of things. There's not any politics in what the best economic model is or the best data. So it's a good working relationship, and those exist throughout Vermont government. You see that at lots of levels in lots of state agencies and legislative support staff functions. So I think that's an important element in terms of how Vermont governs, and it is treated as an asset and a positive attribute in the rating agency's assessment of how the state functions and its budgetary ratings.
Listeners, if you have a question top of mind for the state economist and principal economic advisor to the state legislature, now is the time to call. We're going to roll through a lot of different people today. So if you have one right at the tip of your tongue that you'd like to ask Tom Cavett, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can send an email to vermontedition@vpr.org. Tom, you've been advising the legislature throughout the global pandemic, and in many ways, you've been saying the whole time, you know, the legislature and even state leaders in totality are not really in control of what's happening here this year because the pandemic itself is sort of driving the train. And then the federal response has a lot to do with what happens to the state economy. And Becca Ballant told Henry Epp in an interview this week that you said the same thing to incoming lawmakers just the other day. So how do lawmakers figure out what to do, how to think about fiscal and financial issues, how even to think about social issues in relation to their economic, you know, the economic fallout when there is so much uncertainty? Are you advising them to be reactive or proactive? I mean, how should they think about their role?
Well, I think there needs to be tremendous flexibility. And when there's heightened uncertainty about what may happen, it underscores the need to update assumptions, budgets, data as new information comes in. So we've been updating forecasts more frequently, and also just flexibility in the response. I think just in the way the legislature functions, there's tremendous flexibility has been demonstrated. So many of the functions that have had to be done by people working at home have been very effectively performed, and it's really to everyone's credit that things have functioned as well as they have in state government during this time. But it is unprecedented in many ways, both the pandemic and the federal response to it. And so both of these things are entirely new and are massive in their impact. So it's a long way from being over, and continued flexibility is going to be essential. You're right also that, you know, Vermont is kind of a cork in the ocean on this. We're not driving it, but state policy still does matter. The effectiveness with which the virus was contained in Vermont early on had tremendous beneficial economic impacts. A lot of people coming to the state to work remotely, and also the reduced number of deaths and such compared to other places. So there are things that we can do, and we need to do everything we can, but much of this is completely outside of any legislative control. So there's a lot of reaction that has to happen as well.
Yeah. And, you know, flexibility certainly is the name of the game. And we've seen that in the budgeting process throughout 2020. But, you know, all kinds of other legislation also relies on some kind of stability in or at least a projection that, you know, you can have some faith in about what the economy might look like 6 months or a year from now. Everything from Act 250 reform to cannabis policy and projections for revenue. And, you know, all of that is sort of totally up in the air right now. So how does anybody do any legislating in this kind of circumstance?
Well, I think the other thing we do is we try to bracket ranges of possible outcomes so that you can say, if thus and such occurs, then here's the sort of situation we may be looking at. And if something else happens, then here's what it'll look like. So that's typical for forecasting processes in general. But when there's heightened uncertainty, it's even more important that you do alternative simulations about various possible outcomes. And then you can prepare for a range of outcomes, and then as one starts to come into focus as being most likely, then you've already thought about it and anticipated what sorts of things you might do. So I think that's another aspect to how the uncertainty can be handled going forward.
Do you think that by April we'll have a better handle on what the next year's economic outlook is?
Well, the longer we go, the greater the focus will be. Even if you go back 6 months, we've got a lot of additional information on both sides of that coin. So if you're looking at the epidemiological course of things, we have specifics about vaccines that are available. We have potential rollout schedules. We have, better guesses about uptake rates and things like that. And so we can start to see a clearer light at the end of the tunnel. There's a lot of darkness between here and that light, but it's clearer than it was 6 months ago. Same with the federal response. It was, batted around left and right for month after month. The initial House proposal for the last tranche of spending was in May, and it wasn't until just recently that anything went through. Was a bit smaller than had been anticipated, but that did still go through. Now, with these elections in Georgia looking like they may both go to the Democrat side of things, there was likely to be more spending in the near term. So potentially more federal stimulus, and that's been critical to revenue. So the more specific information we have, on developments, the more accurately we can play out future scenarios. But it is a world of unprecedented events, and so I just think people need to understand that and be adaptable and flexible in how we meet this challenge.
Well, and certainly even in your projections, there's been a lot of changeability and flexibility. In August, you told the state's emergency board that you were projecting a $182.4 million loss to the state's general fund in fiscal year 2021 and a more than $100 million loss in fiscal year 2022. And there were also significant losses projected for the transportation fund and the education fund. And those have been changed over the course of the last few months as we've seen federal aid come through and a more robust Vermont economy than anticipated. What should we expect to hear from you later in January? I think you said about the 19th you were expecting to give another report.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question but that, relative to the last official projection, which was in August, that the revenue numbers will be higher. That's the good, but we're still not out of the woods. And what that's going to look like, we're in the process of doing that work now. But it will be higher, and that's entirely due to this phenomenal amount of money that's coursed through the state from federal transfer payments. It's, we'll ultimately probably be north of $7 billion when this next tranche comes through. That is just a staggering amount of money to inject into a relatively small economy. And as noted in other reports we've done, Vermont has gotten a disproportionate share of that money. It's one on a per capita basis. It's received more than almost any other state. And that has enormous benefits, and it shows up in lots and lots of different areas, and has created really a large number of what you might call winners in this that are doing much better than they expected, and there's also a large number of losers that are outside of even the scope of much of that aid. So it's an unusual environment and one that we're trying to bring into focus with the data and information we can provide.
That's Tom Kvett, state economist and principal economic advisor to the Vermont State Legislature. Tom, thank you very much for talking with us today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Jane.
Let's talk now to three new lawmakers about their priorities for the session, what it's like to start in the middle of a global pandemic, and what they hope to accomplish by the end of the spring. First up is a lawmaker new to the Senate, but not to state lawmaking in general. Keisha Rahm is a Democrat representing Chittenden County in the state Senate, and she previously served several terms as a state representative. Nice to talk with you again, Senator Rahm.
Thank you so much, Jane, and I hope it's okay if I start by just honoring that I am with you in your last month hosting Vermont Edition, and you gave me my first radio interview when I was 22 and new to the house. So we've both come a long way, and it's really great to be back with you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Certainly transitions for both of us, I suppose.
That's right.
So let me ask you what your goals are, given the pressures on the state legislature and the overwhelming priority of just dealing with the global pandemic and so much unknown. I mean, we just heard from state economist Tom Cavett that the name of the game is going to be flexibility. You don't necessarily know what's going to be coming up, and it is certainly not a normal session. So, you know, I assume recovering from the pandemic is the top priority for all lawmakers, but you want to fold that into racial and social justice, and you don't see those as separate issues. Tell me how.
Well, you know, first I want to say, and I'm really grateful to follow our state economist and hear that he's more hopeful about federal stimulus and some more economic justice principles we might see infused in Washington. I won't breathe a sigh of relief until January 20th and we see a new president in the White House, but having the potential for the Senate to change in D.C. and all of this change reminds me that, you know, I came in to the House 12 years ago at the start of the Great Recession and when we were on the cusp of a new era with President Obama. And I have not felt as hopeful since. So, you know, going back into a burning building now, starting in the Senate, you know, last night, building off of the other news we've been hearing and participating in, has made me feel like there's a lot more we can accomplish. And there's a lot more we as Democrats have the responsibility to accomplish. You know, to your direct question about racial justice is pandemic recovery. We often are reminded very sadly through major public health events that there is no one we can leave behind because it reinfects all of us. It brings down, you know, our entire communities when one person is sick and doesn't get what they need. And as some folks may or may not know, Black Vermonters have been 4 to 10 times more likely to be infected with COVID-19 than white Vermonters during this pandemic in Vermont. And that's Vermont alone. So we're seeing the same disparities in Vermont that we're seeing across the country. And we can't afford to let that happen, both not letting down our Black Vermonters and making sure they feel just as much a part of our state, but also because no one can be left behind in a pandemic that affects all of us.
So what does that mean to you then in terms of legislating? What do you do to achieve or to further those goals?
One of my main priorities is language access in state government. You know, I've often come on your show and talk about things that aren't particularly splashy and sound a little bit bureaucratic, but economic and health information was about 2 weeks, 3 weeks behind for people who have limited English proficiency in the state. And that's a lot of Black and Brown Vermonters in concentrated areas who are our frontline workers working in our hospitals and our grocery stores. And 2 to 3 weeks of a delay in getting clear information in your own language is a hazard in a pandemic. So, you know, I've been like a broken record throughout the whole campaign and pandemic, just asking folks in state government, has that been interpreted into other languages? Are people getting the translation services they need on the phone? And it's not just health information. I've had reports from New American folks saying that now they didn't get an interpreter properly on the phone in their own language. Now they're being asked to give unemployment money back. This is devastating for people. So that's a major priority for me, is to work on our language access in the state and making sure no one gets left behind without the information they need.
You know, there's also this question, and you mentioned you won't breathe a sigh of relief, you said, until January 20th when President-elect Biden will be inaugurated. But, you know, we're certainly seeing today out of Georgia and throughout the country that there in various sectors of the American population is a mistrust or a distrust of the government. And that crosses constituencies. You know, you were talking about language access, and we were hearing in the Vermont press conference yesterday that when we talk about making sure that Vermonters of color get priority access to the COVID-19 vaccine because of their elevated risk, being sort of pushed ahead in line and told you're a priority may not be language that fills that constituency with trust. And we know that a lot of people don't even trust the way that the federal election has gone. So how do you work to rebuild trust in the government across all kinds of Vermonters as you think about this virtual and strange session and all of the priorities you have to deal with?
It's such a great point, and it's certainly not enough to put Black and Brown Vermonters or BIPOC Vermonters, in that particular category. But at the same time, I want to pause and celebrate that. I want to thank Dr. Levine and Governor Scott. That's a brave thing to do, to say these are people who've been more affected, and it may not be necessarily because of their race, but because of systemic racism that they've faced in the healthcare system, in society, and in terms of who's had access to what resources. We've already seen coming out of some early reports that BIPOC business owners were at the back of the line for economic relief, and no economic well-being is health and is health care. And so, for even that alone has shown that people have a reason to mistrust government. And it's, potentially on all sides. I mean, we as senators have been talking about, who in our various districts in the more rural parts or, in our urban areas, who doesn't trust government? And it cuts across a lot of identities. We have a responsibility to do more listening. I believe our medical community is trying to figure out how to recompense for years and decades and generations of leaving Black and Brown people behind in healthcare. And it's a deep reckoning that's happening. And I want to applaud the medical community in some ways for being out in front on that. Every sector of society has that reckoning to do, and to take that step in the last few days is monumental. I would build on that with encouraging and supporting high-profile Black and Brown Vermonters to talk about their healthcare story, to talk about why they've had mistrust and why they're proud to get the vaccine today. I do think it comes back to those intersections with culture as well, though. The information can't just be translated into another language. It has to be translated culturally. There's a lot of reasons people mistrust healthcare, not just because of the words that people are saying, but because they've had a bad experience with a healthcare system that told them one thing and did another. And that needs to be dealt with, not just in the words that we speak, but in our actions and in how we reprioritize the Vermonters that are most at risk and most sick right now.
That's Keisha Rahm, a Democrat representing Chittenden County in the Vermont Senate. Senator Rahm, thank you very much for talking with us. Good luck this session.
Thanks so much, Jane. And if I don't get to say it, thanks for your many years on Vermont Edition. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
Oh, thank you very much. Let's turn now to the Progressive Party. This was a historic election for progressives in the Vermont House. Four new progressive representatives were elected, the most House seats gained by the party in a single year. Josh Ronsky, executive director of Vermont's Progressive Party, told us the party's priorities, including advocating for a livable wage, universal health care, and progressive taxation, really resonated with Vermonters, in his opinion, this year in particular.
I think the values that we represent, especially as they relate to working class people, people are struggling right now because of COVID, because of a whole host of things. And I think they're really looking at our message of economic justice, first and foremost, as something that's really valuable.
Ronsky said there were other reasons this election was exciting for the party, too.
From an identity perspective, it's really exciting for us that, six out of the seven progressive House caucus members are female identifying. And it's actually a majority of the caucus are members of the LGBTQ plus community as well.
That's Josh Ronsky, executive director of Vermont's Progressive Party. Heather Supernaut is one of those newly elected female identifying representatives for the Windsor 4-1 district. And Representative Supernaut joins us now. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much. I'm truly humbled to be here.
Oh, well, we're glad to have you. We're excited to talk with you. And I wonder, Josh Ronsky was saying it's important that six out of the seven Progressive House caucus members are female identifying. What does that mean to you as one of the members?
I think it is so important because for so long, female voices in the political system have really been so minimal. And to have this new wave of progressive female voices just taking the state house by storm has been one of the most inspiring things that I've been able to witness as a new legislator. I think what it means is that we are now centering female voices, and we are making inclusivity something that is so central to our platform. And what it means for me is, you know, I have three younger sisters and one older sister, and when I think about them out in the world, I'm just like, this is remarkable. They are going to be able to look at representation that is in government for them and know that their voices and their ideas are going to be carried through. And that's so inspiring to me.
Wow. Four sisters. You got a lot of sisters.
Oh, five of us. So many.
So, you know, not to center men's perspectives here, but why should men also be excited about the fact that there are so many more women entering state politics and working in that intersectional way? How do you believe this carries everybody forward?
I think the way it carries everyone forward is it's a diversity in ideas and perspective. And I think that the more diverse voices that you have present in a political setting, the better off you're going to be when you're trying to craft legislation that's supposed to benefit all Vermonters. I think that, you know, when you have a very homogenous political environment, that it's going to be very difficult when you're actually trying to craft legislation that's supposed to help everyone. And I think having those female voices present is only going to work to help open up new channels of thinking.
Does that extend to differences of political opinion? We're going to speak with one of your Republican colleagues next. And, you know, the Democrats and progressives no longer have a supermajority in the state house. So does having new and more Republican colleagues to work with also enhance that diversity of thought and better the legislation that you're going to be able to move through?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's no doubt about it. When you hear the phrase needing to reach across the aisle and work with your fellow legislators, having conservative voices is absolutely essential. I mean, there's clearly conservatives that are present in the state of Vermont. And I think that I try to remind folks that we're not this liberal bastion that I think people believe Vermont to be. We are very conservative also. And having this variety of voices present is so critical at moving along the conversations in all respects, truthfully.
One of the other perspectives that you bring is that of the agricultural community. You yourself are a farmer, and you want to make sure in your role as a representative that you are bringing agricultural concerns and issues to the table. We have seen this year the loss of farms, dairy farms in particular, continue in Vermont and exacerbated by depressed milk costs right at a time when dairy farmers were thinking they'd be able to recover a little bit from really difficult milk pricing over the last several years. So how do you address agricultural concerns right now, again, when so much focus is just on getting people to survive the pandemic?
Well, you know, this is something that I think is weighing on my heart so deeply as a farmer. And I think that you can't leave agriculture out of the conversation. I mean, especially when you are looking at one in three Vermonters being food insecure right now, farming plays an absolutely critical role in addressing that. And I think additionally, we need to recognize that our farmers and our food producers are truly the fabric of Vermont's rural economy, and making sure that they are present and part of this conversation and what they need is being addressed as well. And I think that having a farm voice present in the Vermont House is going to hopefully, and this is what I aim to do so much, is elevate the voices of what those farmers need. And I think, you know, we are sometimes forgotten about in our communities with all the work that we're doing behind the scenes, and not just in terms of food security and being those who bridge our communities, but also in what we're doing to mitigate climate change. I mean, agriculture is truly intersectional, and I think that it cannot be left out when we're talking about the pandemic at all.
That's Heather Supernaut, progressive, representing Windsor 4-1. I'm sure we'll hear more from you throughout the session. Representative Supernaut, thanks very much for talking with us.
Jane, thank you so much.
And let's turn now to a newly elected Republican, Michael Morgan, representing Chittenden Grand Isle. Representative Morgan beat out House Speaker Mitzi Johnson in a closely contested race. Representative Morgan, nice to talk with you. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon.
So you just heard your new colleague, Heather Supernaut, talk about the importance of a diversity of voices. How do you see that, especially being someone who represents a minority party in the state house?
Sure. I mean, I fully agree with her message. I'm a retired military officer, and I'm a graduate of the United States Air Force Academy, and I sat on the Air Force Academy's Diversity Action Panel, and we put deep thought into diversity and the importance of it, and why it's important every walk of life and thought and process is brought into the equation. So I'd have to agree with her 100%. We're on the same page there. I mean, if you have diversity of thought, you bring dialogue to the table versus stagnation, and you allow for, again, that diversity of people gives diversity of thought, gives good dialogue, and I think will craft and create better legislation for all Vermonters.
That's a theme through all three of you. You know, Keisha Ram was saying the same thing in the sense that all Vermonters need to be able to feel heard in Montpelier and to have a voice and to have their interests represented. So how do you, what do you want to do on that vein to bring different perspectives to the state house and to make sure that Vermonters who may not feel represented currently feel differently about their state government and, in fact, are being treated differently because they are being represented?
Well, it was one of the themes that we ran in our campaign this past fall was to reach out to those that felt like they've been kind of left behind, and it could be for a multitude of reasons. But especially in the sense of, and I don't want to say necessarily because they were conservative minded or Republican minded like I might be, but in the sense of they didn't feel their voice had been heard at the table for a bit. And that appealed to them that maybe, electing different people, to the body would get their voice heard, because there was a good chunk of people that had gotten to us as now constituents saying, hey, I'm not being listened to. And we utilized that as a, I wouldn't say the focal point, but a component of our campaign to go, we want to reach out to everybody and everybody to be heard and everybody to be responded to and talked to.
So what might that look like in terms of legislation that you try to move forward, or, you know, how you respond to legislation that's proposed by the dominant party?
Well, I'm hopeful, and I have to be ever. I'm forever the optimist, so I like to be hopeful that there were gains on the Republican side. They were small gains, but they were gains that is taken note of and noticed, and that it does lead to more reaching across the aisles, I believe I heard mentioned earlier, and talking more and dialoguing more, and which would allow for Leland Morgan, my seatmate from the district, and I to bring forward those ideas of people that kind of felt, dialogue in as we discuss various bills, whether it might be, you know, economic recovery or, you know, future bills that could possibly plague or hurt or help.
Give me a specific example of what you think that might look like, what one perspective that you have on something you want to bring to the table.
Well, I can give you, for instance, something I think is regressive in the sense of, and one of the things that's been, I've been hearing a ton from folks that were citizens that are now, as of today, constituents, is with the augmentation or the implementation of the Global Warming Solutions Act last biennium, there's talk of taking the TCI or the Transportation Climate Initiative, which we're a part of, and expanding that and potentially seeing if there was legislation passed on, and where we're in a hurting economy, adding upwards of 17 cents a gallon to gas and diesel. For people that, especially in our district, a lot of them commute pretty good distances to get to jobs where they go. Representative Supernaut, who was on before, being a farmer, there's still a good amount of farming in our district, and it would hurt those folks that put food on our table. So I'm hoping that we can stay away from some of that legislation this session and focus on other things And those are the kind of things that I'm hearing right now.
You've also said that you want to minimize frivolous legislation or feel-good bills. What might those look like that you'd be pushing against?
Well, that, you know, there would be one. That would be the, that would be a big one for me right there, because, again,
would that be frivolous or feel good?
Well, I don't. I would just say it's at this point, I think it would be a crippling blow for Vermonters. They're already hurting, I guess, is the best way I'm going to describe that. But again, you know, I'm listening to constituents, and that's the resounding theme I've heard from them is do what you can to push back on that. We just don't have it. I mean, we're already looking, I think you're aware, and I think people are, as a populace, are pretty well aware that from an educational perspective, because of the downturn of the economy, the educational system in the state is going to be looking for a pretty significant increase in the property taxation on the school side. Again, I'll use the words crippling is what I hear from my constituent base. So we've got to, when I say, you know, I guess they're frivolous or feel good legislation, we got to focus on meat and potatoes legislation, things that will help recover the economy, things that will help get people back on their feet. You heard Representative Supernaut speak to the farming community being hurt. They are already in a hurting status. They're now hurting worse. And we've got to do things that aren't regressive to them and look out for them.
Michael Morgan is a Republican House member representing Chittenden Grand Isle. Representative Morgan, thanks very much for talking with us, and good luck to you this session.
You bet. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
You too. We just heard from three newly positioned lawmakers and the legislature's chief economist. Let's turn now to David Sheets, state curator. We've talked with him over the years about many facets of the physical state house building itself, but today we're going to talk with him about a different responsibility. David Sheets, you don't technically run the legislative page program, but you wind up doing a lot of work with it and finding things for pages to do, and we wanted to talk with you for just a few minutes specifically about that program. Welcome back to the show.
Absolutely. Great to have you with us again, Jane, in the rooms where it happens.
Yes, in the Zoom rooms
normally,
where it happens.
But now we can't quite be in the physical rooms this year.
No.
Alas.
So let's talk about the PAGE program. As I said, you don't run it, but the legislative PAGE program for eighth graders is canceled for 2021. Not a hard decision, possibly, given the safety considerations and the fact that everything is remote, but maybe a sad one, especially for the eighth graders who were looking forward to it. Will they get a chance next year, do you think, this year's eighth graders?
Not this year, but that decision was made a while ago by the Sergeant-at-Arms, Janet Miller, who runs the program and does a beautiful job, along with her phalanx of doorkeepers, who I would submit are also not going to be as active this year in running the legislature. So a lot of the staffers who work for the Sergeant-at-Arms to keep the building humming and rumming, that's just not going to happen. But what is important about the PAGE program is it's an educational program. It is intended and always has been to give eighth graders an opportunity to interact with the legislature and to learn the process and what goes on in state government in general. And that opportunity, that educational opportunity, is something that I know the Sergeant-at-Arms and my office want to widen and expand and make more widely available to students throughout Vermont. So civics education is a big part of what we're trying to do with the State House in general and have been for years. We have we're the most heavily visited school site in Vermont by far. And yet those schools are not going to be visiting the physical building this year. So we are attempting to get a lot of our programming with Angelica Caterino, our tours coordinator, developing these things to be online so that not only students and their teachers can access them, but parents who are homeschooling their kids can access these resources. So we're working right now to get a virtual tour of the State House online that everybody can access during this time, and to really learn the rudiments of what is involved in government, starting with empowering kids to understand that they can have great ideas that will make life better in their communities, and that that's kind of the beginning of being a good citizen. And then being a good citizen means voting, and being a good citizen means maybe paying attention to the issues that matter to you as they find fruition in bills at the State House.
So, David, let me ask you specifically about the pages, though, because it's canceled for this year and you are working on expanding civics education and access to the State House, whether it's virtual or in person, so that students have a better sense of how government runs and where they might fit in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it comes to the pages, originally, pages did a lot of running around and running papers from one lawmaker to the next, or a message that a lawmaker might need to receive from elsewhere. And, you know, with digital media, even though lawmakers aren't necessarily supposed to be checking their phones in the chamber, that's different now. You know, that's different.
The Sergeant-at-Arms office and the doorkeepers have been struggling with that for years in recent times, of course, because you're quite right. The cell phone has put a lot of the duties that used to be running a little handwritten message on a piece of paper from one person to another. That's just not happening anymore. And so we have tried to turn the program, frankly, into more of an educational opportunity for the kids than it used to be. They didn't have time to do anything but their duties in the past. But now the experience can be a better one, that is, as soon as the pandemic is over and we actually have pages again in the building. But you're right. That, like a lot of things during the pandemic, we're looking top to bottom at the State House and trying to turn the experience that all people have in the building into a fruitful educational one. And it's from students to adults. We're looking at all of that and evaluating it during this pause and coming back hopefully with even better programs in the future.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing more about that. That's David Sheets, State Curator. Thank you very much for talking with us, David.
Thank you, Jane.
And finally today, Matthew Romei is Chief of Capitol Police and joins us again as you did last year. Chief Romei, thank you for joining us on opening day.
It's my pleasure. Glad to be here.
Different than most opening days. What are you actually doing today?
Well, actually, we've had the first round of events in the House and Senate already. That has come and gone. And now we are kind of in a pause waiting on the next gaveling in of the sessions. The sessions are still being run out of the State House. So where we would normally have 600-700 people, maybe 1,000 people in the State House on a normal opening day, I think we capped out around 75 today.
Wow.
So it's been quite a change.
So, you know, over the course of the last couple of weeks and months, there have been a lot of questions about where lawmakers would be in this session. Might they be in the Berry Auditorium? Could they be in various different places? It looks like most of the session will be remote, but there will still be people in the State House. How does Capitol Police, which is a deputized police force, you know, how do you think about how to protect lawmakers and protect the public and you know, do this while so much is changing in the physical spaces where lawmakers will be?
Well, there was an old phrase that I pulled back from college when we started, when this whole event started to unfold last spring, and it's Semper Gumby, you know, much like the Marine Corps, you know, Semper Fidelis, Semper Paratus for the Coast Guard, you know, Semper Gumby. If you remember the Gumby cartoon character, the one that could stretch out and mold to whatever event was facing them. And I think that's something that we've done well, is that we have been flexible and willing to adapt to what was facing us on the fly. We have not missed a day being open since the pandemic started, and we've been very fortunate. Our officers have remained healthy. We've done a few things to try to ensure that, separating people out. But, you know, we've, just like every other public safety agency in the state and across the country, we have to be here. We've had a pretty significant summer and fall, as it went, in realms of protests and rallies on the lawn. And every one of those requires some level of our attention.
Right.
As they go by.
Yeah, I was going to say, you haven't exactly had a quiet summer, even though lawmakers weren't in the statehouse. There were a lot of protests and demonstrations on the steps of the statehouse and the statehouse grounds.
One of the media members that was here covering opening day this morning reminded me of the old blessing, or maybe it's a curse, I don't know. But, you know, may you live in interesting times. And quite honestly, I'll take a couple weeks of boredom if you've got any laying around.
How did you address, you know, some of the protests that were very contentious, and some of which were really addressing anger towards police forces specifically?
Well, you know, we're a unique law enforcement agency in that we have somewhat of a mission that you don't find everywhere else. And that is sometimes that we have to ensure points of view that are very far apart from our own. And I'm proud of the officers of the Capitol Police Department. We went through some of those protests where people were genuinely angry. And it wasn't anything that we had done individually, but it was at the industry. And you know, we went through it. We kept our heads high. I remind all my officers every day, you know, you are the best emissary for law enforcement that we can have. And go out there and show these folks that even in the face of the adversity and, you know, contentiousness, that we remain professional and we do our jobs.
So are there any new types of threats that you're either dealing with this session or concerned about that we should know about?
Well, it is a little easier when we have everyone in one place, but sometimes it's also a little harder when the inherent risk of getting everyone into one place poses. But we're still in daily contact with the legislative members and the staff, and we respond to their needs and concerns just as if they were in the building.
So, Chief Romei, can I expect to see a Semper Gumby patch on your uniform the next time I see you at the Statehouse? I would like to make sure that that actually happens.
There may actually be a patch that exists. However, I don't know that I can get away with putting it on my uniform.
All right. Well, regardless, good luck this session. And, you know, I'm sure we'll be hearing more from you as we progress to see what unfolds. But thank you very much for speaking with us today on opening
day.
Thank
you. We're really looking forward to seeing the public again, hopefully in the Statehouse soon.
Yes. Well, aren't we all? That's Chief Romei, Matthew Romei, Chief of the Capitol Police. Thanks for talking with us.